Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Just one guest today, the journalist Liza Featherstone, talking about her new book, Divining Desire, a study of focus groups published by Orr Books in partnership with Counterpoint. The effects of focus groups are all around us, consumer products, entertainment products, political products. Malcolm Gladwell famously blamed the flop that was New Coke way back in 1985 on focus groups. As he so often is, Gladwell was wrong. If a movie seems banal, we may blame it on a focus group. And politicians like George W. Bush and Donald J. Trump often brag about not using focus groups. Bush was lying, and as far as we know, Trump isn't. We often condemn politicians like either Clinton, Bill, or Hillary for being entirely the inauthentic product of focus groups. The late Steve Jobs was contemptuous of them. People who like to think of themselves as original thinkers and bold leaders are often that way. But, on the other hand, what is wrong with trying to find out what people think about your product, whether it be a movie, a soft drink, or an agenda? How pervasive are these things? Where did they come from? Spoiler, a bunch of Viennese socialist intellectuals 80 years ago. What is the process like? What do marketers think of them and their participants? And what do they mean in the larger scheme of things? These are the questions that Liza Featherstone looks at in Divining Desire. Her larger point is that focus groups are symptomatic of what she calls our culture of consultation. In a world of pseudo-democracy, where people have little power, elites have devised a whole set of institutions and practices to make them feel listened to. Focus groups are one of those. Featherstone is the author of several books, including Selling Women Short, the story of the giant sex discrimination suit against Walmart. She also writes an advice column, which covers the interface of the political and the personal, for The Nation magazine. And I must also say she is my wife. But my admiration for her work is not the result of nepotism. My admiration for her work is one of the many reasons I married her. Okay, here's the first part of my interview with Liza Featherstone, author of Divining Desire, Focus Groups and the Culture of Consultation. Let's start with a basic definition. What is a focus group?
A focus group is a group of about, usually about 8 or 12 people led by a moderator. They are led in focusing, usually on a particular question or text. Often it's a piece of advertising or a particular product. Both parts of the term are important. The term focus, as this was an innovation to really try to get groups to focus together on a particular text, and the group part is also important as well.
And this is used in a wide variety of things, right? Politics, consumer products?
Just about everything in our life that surrounds us may well have been produced or approved or tested by focus group. We focus group consumer products, advertising, political messages, and of course that's the part that gets most attention.
And as you go around talking about this book, do you find that people are full of ideas on what focus groups are? They know what they are, have opinions?
Yeah, people do have a lot of opinions about focus groups. A lot of people have been part of focus groups, have been participants. Also, most people are part of the culture of hating focus groups. Even though focus groups are a completely integral part of our marketing mechanisms and completely integrated into our political life, most people still kind of hate them.
And what is the hatred based on?
The hatred comes from two places. Professionals, elites and the professionals who do their thinking for them are the biggest users of focus groups. They're the most likely to have to conduct a focus group to see what people think about their product or their political message or what have you. But they don't like it. They don't like having to listen to the people. You get all these uninformed people in a room, and it's really frustrating for the clients. One market researcher said the clients hate the focus groups because they learn that people don't really care that much about them or their products. It's injurious to their narcissism. But on the other hand, they also hate the way that these people are given so much space to hold forth. It can seem kind of unfair to them that these uninformed ordinary people are allowed to talk and are given a platform. And I interviewed a lot of people who had been on the client side who did indeed feel that way. On the other hand, most people sort of hate focus groups as part of the masses. We feel these people don't really represent us somehow. Like, we look at focus groups on TV, you know, Frank Luntz is interviewing a bunch of slow-witted seeming regular Americans who can't seem to make up their mind about basic issues of the day. The title of one of my chapters comes from watching TV with a friend, and a focus group of this kind comes on TV, and she says, "Who are these appalling people?" And who are these appalling people is a reaction a lot of us have in response to focus groups. We look at them and we say, you know, like, wow, are we really meeting our fellow Americans? This is quite distressing. And you see this in a lot of online commentary about the focus groups. Video game message boards, people say this is a terrible game. It must have been made by a focus group. Movies, same thing. People really have a tendency to feel that the focus groups are to blame.
As Adolf Reed once said, no one ever self-identified as a member of the masses.
Exactly. We all feel that we're a bit above average, at least, and so the focus groups are sort of deplorable, to use Hillary Clinton's memorable term, precisely because of their averageness. We all want to place ourselves just at least a little bit above the deplorable.
But on the other hand, all these appalling deplorables are quite happy to have an opportunity to vent and have someone listen to them.
People love to be in the focus groups. That's right. If we're on that side of it as part of the focus group, we generally really enjoy ourselves. We like to have our opinion heard. People really like the feeling of being listened to. Market researchers comment on that a lot. People say, thank you so much for listening to me. And the people I interviewed who were frequent participants in focus groups mentioned that too. One woman said, in fact, it might speak to a desperation to be heard, how much she enjoyed participating.
Since it seems like no one else is listening.
That's right.
Let's go back to the history of these things. They have a curious origin among a bunch of Viennese socialists, not the kinds of people that you would think of as inventing this very standard capitalist practice.
That's right. It's not cooked up in Procter & Gamble conference room. So in the 1920s, Vienna was in the rather unique position of having municipal socialism in one city, despite a very conservative government in the rest of Austria. The socialists who had come to power were very smart, very intellectual, very well-educated, very much members of an intelligentsia, members of an elite in Vienna.
Who presumed to speak for the masses.
Yes. So they were social democrats. They were very committed both to making a certain idea of socialism work and for making democracy work, which was also quite a new thing in that political context. They quickly realized to have both, to make socialism and to make democracy work, you had to have some idea of what the people were thinking. And they were quite detached as members of the elite. You know, they were psychoanalysts, they were academics, they weren't very connected to the working class. And the ideas that they had about the working class was more or less on board with their economic ideas, good public services and general redistribution of wealth. But the Viennese socialists also wanted the working class to really be all around more wholesome people. They wanted them to not have sex outside of marriage, not drink so much, play team sports, join chess clubs.
They wanted to take much of the joy out of life.
Yes, they wanted to take a lot of joy out of life. And they wanted to, they also wanted to impose, you know, and we can debate whether this is a good or a bad idea. They wanted to impose their ideas about culture onto the masses. They wanted them to listen to opera rather than to soap operas. The working class was not very interested in doing these things, playing team sports, listening to opera. And years later, Paul Lazarsfeld, who would go on to invent the focus group, and was a young Viennese socialist at the time, very active in the party, explained that they had developed all these new qualitative research methods, new ways of listening to people, because, he said, we wanted to understand why our propaganda was unsuccessful. So the focus group emerges from a variety of qualitative methods that were first became necessary in this context, where an elite has a lot of ideas about how to improve society, but finds that those ideas require a better understanding of the masses, and that in fact there's quite a gulf between the elites and the masses. So that was something that even though they were socialists, the Viennese struggled with.
So into Vienna then steps Hitler, right?
Yes.
And these guys relocate.
Right. Well, first another right-wing movement, but then Hitler, yes.
Tell us about the relocation of the center of the focus group to Columbia University.
Paul Lazarsfeld, while being active in the Socialist Party, was also flourishing as a young scholar, trying out all kinds of qualitative research at an institute in Vienna. He has to flee the Nazis, being Jewish and a socialist, and he comes to the United States. There's a variety of adventures in there, but he ends up at Columbia University, where he is very innovative about how to secure support for his research, and he really pioneers commercial contracts and government contracts. Now that's considered quite commonplace in academia to finance parts of your research enterprise in these ways. But then it was quite unusual. One of his contracts is with the Office of War Information, the Roosevelt administration. And once again, a group of well-intentioned social democrats wants to understand why their propaganda is unsuccessful. The Roosevelt administration is trying to convince the American masses to make the sacrifices needed, both in lives and material comforts, to enter World War II. And the American masses are not particularly interested in doing that. And Paul Lazarsfeld and his bureau are charged with testing the propaganda and figuring out why. Out of this research comes something that we would now very much call the focus group.
I'm speaking with Liza Featherstone, author of Divining Desire from Or Books and Counterpoint Books. So how did they make the transition from being a propaganda outfit into being a commercial enterprise?
So sometimes there are these characters in history whose personalities encompass all these different contradictions and somehow make these transitions work. So Lazarsfeld is a committed social democrat, but he's also quite a hustler. He's got a hustle on even back in Vienna. So some of his early qualitative research is market research, even back in Vienna, where he's studying all kinds of worthy social topics like unemployment and trying to figure out how to get people to embrace municipal socialism. He's also testing how can local laundromats get people to send out their laundry. He discovers that when interviewed about their real feelings, housewives feel guilty sending out their laundry, but they would do it if someone in the family had recently died, because then they felt justified in abdicating this labor of doing the wash themselves. So then the laundromats took this on board and would then target with pamphlets of houses in which someone had recently died.
And they didn't go around killing people.
They didn't go around killing people. But this is to say that the commercial impulse and the social democratic were always intertwined in the person of Paul Lazarsfeld. So he was always trying out these methods for both purposes. Once they really invent the focus group at Columbia, when working for the Office of War Information, it moves very quickly to Madison Avenue, partly because the Columbia researchers are busily taking on commercial contracts. They're working for media companies, they're working for consumer products, they're alongside the propaganda on Nazis, they're also testing commercials for a relief of stomach acid. Many of Lazarsfeld's students go into work on Madison Avenue. People immediately see that that's going to be both profitable and interesting. Most significantly in this period, Lazarsfeld's third wife, Herta Herzog, who was also first a student of his, which was not something that was particularly frowned upon in that non-Me Too moment. She leaves the bureau and goes to work on Madison Avenue, and she really develops the focus group much further as a specifically for testing commercial products, and she becomes very well known for that. But many of his other students do this as well.
In the early days of the focus group, it bears its Viennese stamp in that psychoanalysis was also a very large portion of their technique. Talk about that role of psychoanalysis in early focus group work.
Yes, yes. Herta Herzog is particularly psychoanalytically inclined, as were many of their Viennese colleagues. In fact, there's a character on Mad Men who is almost certainly inspired by the person of Herta Herzog. There's a lady with a Viennese accent who writes a report for Don Draper on cigarettes and the death drive. This is very plausible. This is exactly the kind of work they would have done. There's a lot of psychoanalytic influence. Another figure quite prominent in that is Ernest Dichter, who was actually also a student of Lazarsfeld and also Viennese. And he becomes very famous. He does focus groups and finds a lot of unconscious drives motivating consumers, a lot of sexuality in what people are looking for in a car. He helps develop the marketing of the Barbie doll.
Make the breasts bigger, right?
Yeah, make the breasts bigger. But also how Barbie spoke to the aspirations of little girls to become big girls. And
even so, if the mothers weren't comfortable with it.
Yes, mothers were very uncomfortable with the sexuality, and there were actually some adjustments change her dress, make her a little bit less sexual, because mothers are the ones who are going to be buying the Barbie. But one of the interesting things, though, is that while observers at the time made much of all the sexual drives and the obsessions with death, and all that interesting stuff that we associate with European psychoanalysis, what was actually more at work with mid-century American market research was not so much the influence of Freud as we think of him.
The sex and death guy.
The sex and death guy. Not so much the sort of depressive resignation to, ordinary unhappiness, but much more a different Viennese psychoanalyst, Adler, who was very influential on Lazarsfeld, Dichter, Herta Herzog, all those Viennese who were working on the focus group. And what's different about Adler than Freud is that he really emphasizes the adaptation of the individual, and the way that the individual needs to function within the collective, within the group. So The focus group is the perfect way to look at how the individual responds to things in a social context. You know, whether that's products, political messaging, but also, Adlerian psychology is really well suited to looking at our aspirations. It was really about aspiration as much as it was about these dark drives and how
aspirations cathected into a consumer product.
Exactly. How consumer products could speak to our aspirations. So it's not so much the tits on the Barbie that are critical, it's the little girl's desire to become big girls. You know, and it's and the sort of the
and it certainly has nothing to do with primal nostalgia for mother.
Yeah.
Troublesome stuff.
I mean, it may have, but that wasn't primarily what the mid-century advertisers were tapping into. They were really seeing how consumer products could speak to our dreams.
Which fit very nicely with the golden age narratives of the 50s. Consumption is freedom.
You know, exactly.
Our products will bury the commies.
Exactly.
That stuff fit right in.
Yes, and the focus group is extremely important in this Cold War context because elites are engaged in an extremely challenging persuasive project. They're trying to persuade people who have been used to making sacrifices in World War II to now switch to a much more materialistic lifestyle. And they're trying to convince people to buy all this stuff that most people don't really need that much. But then they're also trying to engage people in a larger ideological project of embracing consumer capitalism as something superior to communism. A lot of the rhetoric in this period emphasizes how our way of life is so much better because everybody can have all of this stuff. It emphasizes the ways in which consumer capitalism is really just like socialism because it can allow ordinary people to live like kings.
Even better.
Yeah.
But it's a nice fusion of the propagandistic roots of the thing with monetary interest.
Yes, very much so.
That was the first part of my interview with Liza Featherstone, author of Divining Desire, Focus Groups and the Culture of Consultation, published by Orr Books in partnership with Counterpoint. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of the Barcarolle from Eine Naturtrilogie by Heinz Thiessen, performed by Matthew Rubinstein. And now on to part two of my interview with Liza Featherstone, author of Divining Desire, from Orr Books and Counterpoint. There was a big backlash that developed in the 50s against marketing, market research, and the focus group very much part of that. The star of that, perhaps now forgotten, Vance Packard, but that he still casts a long shadow even today, 50, 60 years later, right?
That's right. Vance Packard emerges in this period as a tremendously influential critic of market research and focus groups and market research in general. And yeah, although most people have not heard of him, he remains tremendously influential on the left-wing view of advertising and focus groups. he was a the son of a Protestant minister. It really comes across when you read the when you read his book, The Hidden Persuaders, which was startlingly a huge bestseller. I mean, today,
mid-late '50s.
Yeah, it was published in 1957. A huge bestseller. I mean, and you know, which is kind of funny today because, I mean, it would be as if. I can't even think what's the most paranoid and overheated left-wing book you can think of. I mean, you know, it's like...
Some of them may have been my guests, so I don't want to say...
Yeah, exactly.
Don't want to mention it.
They're probably whoever the author of that is probably listening. But it's very paranoid and overheated, and he doesn't quite say that subliminal messaging exists, but he alludes to the possibility that advertisers are sending people subliminal messages to get us to buy more. He's horrified.
I mean, that entered folk wisdom, because I remember people were saying, you go to the drive-in movie, it's going to say, buy Coke now.
That's right.
Flashed on for a millisecond, and then suddenly there will be an influx of people
at the
drink stand.
That's right. There were a lot of myths floating around at that time subliminal messaging and how far along that was. Packard researched market research and was very disturbed by the psychoanalysis. He was very horrified by the idea that that sex drives would play a part in our desires for focus groups and that corporations would exploit these. It's not just that it reads as naive from our, you know, now jaded, you know, we're so used to advertising and we're like, oh, of course sex sells things. It is also this tremendously parochial and defensive American attitude toward psychoanalysis and the unconscious. That was one of the reasons his book was so popular, is that Americans were really fascinated by Freudianism, but a little upset by it, like a little upset by the idea that they had drives of which they were unaware. And so this was sort of just constantly bubbling over into the pop culture, and it was one of the things that people were so horrified by, and Packard's Hidden Persuaders tapped right into that. Advertisers are exploiting you by looking at your unconscious and using your unconscious desires and drives to sell you things. And this was very upsetting to people. It's really had a long influence because in addition to being very puritanical and also a little sexist, the view of the consumer who was generally in mid-century feminized, partly because women did do so much of the shopping for the household, but also because that was the consumer about which the male industry knew less about. So the female consumer always needed to be further researched. So there's sort of an assumption that the consumer is very vulnerable and is a little bit helpless, and that industry is preying upon her, that is a little patronizing to the modern feminist reader. But it's also I think it's really affected the way the left thinks about consumerism and about persuasion. We've somewhat oversold perhaps how passive the reception of these messages is, and how effective it is. In some ways, the market researchers defending themselves against Packard at the time now sound more credible as they argue, well, actually, you know, people are really complicated. Women are very complicated. That's why we have to do so much research. We don't think that they're stupid or fall for things easily.
And speaking of women, women did play some role in the focus group game, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the consumer was so often thought of as female, and the female consumer was viewed by industry as rather mysterious, there was a great need to talk to women and find out their views. And male market researchers found out fairly quickly they didn't always communicate with the female consumers as well as they could. They sometimes had trouble getting them to really open up and even understanding what they were saying to them. Out of this need to do better listening to women, emerged a need for women researchers. So you see in this period a lot of women going into market research, both at the level of the firm, the advertising firm, but also you see a lot of independent market researchers emerging, women starting their own very small firms. And to this day, a lot of market research is done by women-owned, fairly small market research firms like this.
And as with the larger field of psychology, the focus group moved away from psychoanalysis. What'd they do? What kind of psychology took over?
Yeah, the psychoanalytic focus group really has its day in the 50s, early 60s. Like the rest of the culture, it moves away from that and moves toward much more straightforward discussions of what people's experience actually is with products, or taking a text and relating it to people's actual experience. The type of expertise that is tapped into in leading focus groups shifts away from these psychoanalytically trained people and more toward, for instance, therapists skilled in leading group therapy.
Therapy is becoming more prominent in the shrink field.
Yes, so just as group therapy, again, a very Adlerian influence based on the conviction that the individual really needs to learn how to adapt in the context of a group. The group therapy scenario takes that quite literally and becomes huge in psychotherapy in the 50s, and then many of those therapists moved to Madison Avenue to ply their trade in the focus group. As well, the groups also become just much more straightforward. So even by the 60s, I was looking at tobacco focus groups from the 60s, and they're not exploring how people feel about death or anything like that. And in fact, there's one moment where they're looking at a picture of a hand crushing a box of cigarettes, and the group is discussing the gender. Is this a woman's hand? The group leader doesn't explore whether the group is concerned about castration, the woman's hand is crushing the cigarettes, a 50s group leader, with Viennese training would have certainly probed that. By the 60s, they're just kind of letting all of that go by and just sort of trying to, just trying to figure out, straightforwardly, what are people's experiences and stated desires about products.
Two questions about groups. One, a mundane one, I guess. The group dynamics, what about that? Are they dominated by charismatic people who talk a lot, that sort of marginalize the shy? You would think that, the researchers would want to know what the shy people think as well. So how do they handle all that?
Interestingly, a lot of people think that this is a huge flaw of the focus group, that there are going to be a couple dominant personalities, they're going to talk over everybody or intimidate everyone into thinking the way that they do, and that this is a problem. Market researchers will tell you, and I must say I am convinced by this, it's not a problem, because one of the things that the focus group is doing is looking at the individual in a social context and recognizing that markets are social. So, for example, New Coke. Shall I jump ahead to New Coke?
No, let's wait a moment on New Coke.
Okay, yeah. But it's an example of what talking about.
Yes.
Well, I'll answer your question more abstractly then, which is, if you get a situation in which a dominant personality says, "I hate that," you know, and everybody else, you know, is a little on the fence, but comes around to hate the thing too. That's very valuable information for your client to know, that when it is out in the world, this is the way socially the conversation around your product could play out, because that's the way life is. Powerful personalities do influence us, you know, and you know, the people around us do shape our opinions and reactions to things. We don't really have pure reactions that are not informed by our friends and the people around us. That's something that the market researchers are actually right about. That's not a flaw of the focus group. It's actually a strength that it can really illuminate what goes on with us socially.
And now one more question about groups before I get to New Coke. The consciousness-raising groups, the feminist groups of the 1970s, did they have any inspiration from or influence on the focus group?
Yeah. The 70s is a time where we really love to talk about things in groups. You have encounter groups, you know, where people get together and talk about their feelings. And you have the consciousness-raising groups of the feminist movement. And this receptiveness to groups and this sort of relish of talking about things in groups helps to acclimate the culture to things like the focus group. It's also, in this period, the two often seem so parallel, because part of what's being discussed in focus groups at that time, even the focus groups on consumer products, is gender roles. Advertisers are really trying to figure out how to appeal to women in a time in which gender roles are changing. Women are very annoyed with sexist advertising. Advertising itself becomes a target of feminist criticism. So there very much is a sort of a cultural fluidity between what's going on in the focus groups and what's going on in the consciousness-raising groups.
I'm speaking with Liza Featherstone, author of Divining Desire from Or Books and Counterpoint Books. And now, failures. You write at length about two reputed failures of the focus group, the Edsel and New Coke. I'll let people read about the Edsel in the book. But New Coke and Malcolm Gladwell had a lot to do with making this alleged failure popular. Truth?
It's really not a failure. It's a very interesting thing. There's a great desire to scapegoat the focus group and blame the focus group for what are essentially failures at the top of the corporation. That's something that we see in the Edsel story too, so people will enjoy that when they read it. So this is trotted out time and again. People will say, focus groups are terrible, and New Coke is a perfect example of a terrible, unpopular product produced by a focus group. First of all, New Coke was actually tested in focus groups. People liked the taste, but people very much didn't like the idea of changing a beloved product. And in focus groups, they talked about that. You hear from so many self-appointed experts, and Malcolm Gladwell is only the most famous one. They didn't ask the right question. They didn't ask people how they felt about the changing of a beloved brand. It's not true. They did. They did ask people how they felt about changing a beloved brand, and the reception in the focus group to that was fairly negative. But Coke didn't listen. Anyone who was alive at the time remembers the public outrage.
Even an anti-American commie like me was outraged.
Of course. They were changing Coke.
I know. One of the better things about American culture.
I know. Well, so here's what happened in the focus groups. What happened was, they said, how would you feel about, we're going to change a prominent soft drink, you know, that has, you know, been part of American culture, it's been part of everyday life. A slight majority of the group says they'd be interested in trying it. A few people freak out completely and say, this is terrible, this is the worst idea, I hope they're not going to change Coke, you know, and you know, these people are very upset, that vocal minority gets the rest of the group very upset, and then everybody's upset, everyone in the focus group is upset. Interestingly, this exactly mirrored what happened in the culture. Coke rolls out its new Coke after, you know, Bill Cosby, you know, we look on that a bit differently now, but at the time it's hard to remember he was in fact quite beloved in American culture. He goes on in an ad and says he's been a lifelong Coke drinker and he loves the new Coke. You know, there's this sort of big rollout. At first, people like it. This tastes even better. It's a little more like Pepsi, which in taste tests people actually generally do
sweeter, like, and less gassy, as I recall.
Yeah. People generally did want their Coke to taste more like Pepsi in taste tests, and people like it better at first when it's rolled out. But a very vocal minority freaks out completely in the marketplace, just as they did in the focus groups. They get upset. They call Coca-Cola's headquarters. Coca-Cola has to set up a hotline just to receive all the upset people. They're calling and saying things like, you know, it's as if you have destroyed the American flag. I feel as if somebody died. People are very upset. This feeling of upset, and this is before the internet. I mean, can you imagine the outrage that this would be the outrage of the month on the internet now? But despite the lack of the internet, they managed to get everybody else in the culture very upset about this too. And then it's just a comprehensive market rejection of new Coke,
which is a reproduction of what happened in the focus groups.
An exact reproduction of what happened in the focus groups.
So they'd only listened.
That's really the conclusion. I mean, that the whole story is really hardly a repudiation of the focus group, but actually an affirmation of perhaps they should have listened. But it's interesting that these mythologies around the focus group and how useless it is tend to really take hold because elites want to believe it, because elites hate having to consult the focus group, because they hate having to consult ordinary people about corporate decisions. And the rest of us also sort of want to believe it too, because we resent these focus groups. We don't feel these people really speak for us. We don't like the feeling of being manipulated. We don't like the feeling of everything in life being so market tested.
Well, it's that feeling you get when you look at Amazon said, people who like X also like Y.
Yeah.
And they're usually right. And you feel, oh, no, it can't be because I'm unique.
Exactly.
This is stomping on my uniqueness.
Exactly. And when something like New Coke happens, our sort of sentimental desire to believe that we're really special and can't be measured by these focus groups really comes into play. And Coca-Cola really took advantage of that. They said, the CEO actually said, you know, it turns out there are some things that are just too special to be measured. And one of them is our feelings about a brand like Coca-Cola. And that's, of course, absolutely ludicrous. If there's one thing that can be measured, it's our feelings about Coca-Cola.
Yes. We're running low on time, so a couple of things more to cover. One is the role of the focus group in politics. And, of course, you know, you have people like W and Trump famously saying they don't use focus groups, when, in fact, W did.
Right.
The use of focus groups in politics excites contradictory impulses. One is that the politicians who listen to focus groups are pandering.
Yeah.
They're failing to lead.
Right.
The other one is that they're manipulating us and trying to make us swallow a bunch of crap we don't want to. How do focus groups function in politics?
Focus groups in politics are contradictory in this way. Over the last couple decades, political messages have been extensively focus grouped, both by Republicans and Democrats, though in some ways Democrats have probably used them more unapologetically and been more famous for their focus group use. Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster, once said admiringly of Bill Clinton, "The focus groups speak and their words come right out of Bill Clinton's mouth." You know, I mean, it's just,
but he made it seem like his own.
It was just part of the mechanism through by which Bill Clinton so seamlessly appeared to speak ordinary Americans' language. He was really listening to the focus groups. It's absolutely true that focus groups do produce a very commercial and watered down political message a lot of the time. However, I think it's also true that if we have an immensely unequal society in which ordinary people have very little influence over politics, probably the focus group is one small way that people are listened to. If it weren't for the focus group, political elites would be even more out of touch than they are. So to be fair, it's extremely inadequate form of listening, but it's better than not listening. That said, what's interesting about the criticism of the focus groups in the political realm is that a lot of it does come from the right. Both H.W. Bush and W. Bush made a lot of theatrical declarations about how they didn't use focus groups, although both of them did. And there was sort of an expectation among conservative voters, particularly, that there was something much more masculine and sort of pleasingly authoritarian about saying you didn't listen, that you didn't listen to the people. W was the decider, he said after the 2003 anti-war protests. He said he made a big thing of how I don't govern by focus group. The focus group just became the stand-in for any input from the public. So the rejection of focus groups takes this aggressive and elitist and anti-democratic form, most dramatically in the recent person of Donald Trump, who said when he was asked if he used focus groups, he said, "Yeah, I do focus groups right here," and he pointed to his head.
Where not much is going on.
But he was trying to communicate that he's too smart for that. He just thinks it all up in his own head. That sort of way that focus groups are sort of scapegoated and stand in for any kind of public input or public listening is also troubling. What should really bother us about focus groups and politics is that as you see the rise of this culture of consultation, this culture of people being constantly listened to.
Like Hillary Clinton's listening tours.
Absolutely. I mean, she constantly would say, "As some people have told me," like she was always alluding to all the different ways that she was listening to people, and she was an extensively focus grouped, data driven candidate, which is why she appeared to be so inauthentic. One of the reasons she appeared to be so inauthentic. What should really bother us about that is not necessarily the use of the focus groups themselves, but the fact that their prevalence is a symptom of how distant and unaccountable political elites are to the vast majority of people, how this incredibly artificial way of listening to people is their only way of getting any information about what most people think, because they are so far removed, and because most people don't have any institutions representing them or any politicians who really represent them in any kind of authentic way. This culture of consultation that the focus group represents is really a symptom of an extremely unequal culture in which most people are very disempowered. And I think that that's really what should bother us much more than the focus group itself.
And final question, the death of the focus group has been proclaimed or forecast many times. This time it's the internet. Has Mark Zuckerberg killed the focus group?
I found that people, for the last 15 years or so, the business press repeatedly declares the focus group is dead and, you know, writes various obituaries for it, almost always touting some brand new idea that they think is going to replace it. Like, guess what? We've just discovered crowdsourcing, you know, or something, you know. And, you know, a few years later, all of that always looks really silly. It's like, yeah, sure, crowdsourcing. All of these things just become part of the crowd, of the culture of consultation along with the focus group. But in terms of, you know, amount of money spent and, you know, number of businesses still active, the focus group persists in commercial life and political life. And I think that in some form, as long as we have out-of-touch elites who are trying to make democracy and markets work, you know, to work, those things require the participation of the people and some information about their desires. So as long as we have that situation, I think in some form the focus group will persist.
That was the second part of my interview with Liza Featherstone, author of Divining Desire, Focus Groups in the Culture of Consultation, from OR Books in partnership with Counterpoint. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Someone taunted me on Facebook the other day for liking St. Vincent too much, so as a response, here's some St. Vincent singing Mass Seduction. Till next week, bye. Smiling, nihilistic, angry, glass half full, drinking, manicotic, singing, Romans call, teenage Christian virgins, holding out their tongues, paranoid secretions, falling on basement.